Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Allison Horrocks. Allison is a public historian who holds a PhD in history. She has worked at numerous public history sites and is an expert on the history of home economics. Many readers are familiar with the notion of thinking of treasured books as friends. This episode is one of my favorites because it allowed me to listen to what reading has meant in the life of my best friend. If you hear wind in the background, that's because this interview was inexplicably recorded on an unseasonably warm winter's day on the bleachers of a soccer field. From Nancy Drew to American Girl and beyond, this is Allison's story. Okay, Allison, this is a very special episode, not the least of which is because we are recording outdoors, unplanned. This episode was originally supposed to be recorded at a Dunkin' Donuts, which is the second office of our guest today, Allison Horrocks. But instead, there was a birthday party taking place for a 9-year-old girl in the Dunkin' Donuts, and we felt odd, so we left. And now we're sitting in an open field on bleachers, which is ironic because you've never played sports in your life. But here we are. This is great. I'm so excited. Allison is our guest today. Allison is a great historian. She studies American history, women's history, history of home economics. Allison is my best friend, even though Allison would not probably call me her best friend. And I cite that because she prefers to call inanimate objects her best friend. Like a koozie.
I'm having all this cut, Taylor.
No. Taylor, keep this in. Let the facts stand. Anyway, Allison, thank you so much for being on the show today. I so appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary. I'm a longtime podcast listener and really first-time podcast participant. So it's a big day for me.
Very exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
So I guess I want to start how I start every episode by asking where you're from and what your earliest memories of reading are.
So I am a native Rhode Islander. I still live in Rhode Island. I live in a town called Warwick. And to think about my earliest memories of reading, they definitely involve my parents reading to me, which I think has been a common theme and occurrence on this show. I would say some of my earliest memories are related to books. And I also just remember books always being a part of my life, particularly when traveling. Growing up, I remember always being encouraged to have books with me for something to do, and particularly in the car. And I've always been very grateful I'm not a car sick person, because I think my reading library would be so much smaller were it not for that ability to read and travel.
So what are some books from that period that you remember really being meaningful?
I remember really, really enjoying the books with the numbers. So essentially it was a graded level program. So I remember those actually quite well, kind of moving through different steps of reading, like Amelia Bedelia. I also remember reading a lot of Berenstain Bears and Little Critter. The book that sticks out the most of having a very vivid memory of having it read to me is Meet Molly, which we can talk about in depth at various points in this interview, but the American Girl's first book on Molly McIntyre. That's a very vivid memory. That was a Christmas present, probably one of the best presents I ever got. So that's a very, very vivid memory.
Do you want to get into that now, or do you want to wait and...
Sure. So I know that that's a kind of shared interest that we have.
Yes.
So thinking back on that book, it was a Christmas present. And I remember getting the doll that accompanied. And I also remember being told that I could get more dolls if I read more books, which was kind of the best bargain for me of all time. Not a problem. And I just remember finding the story really compelling. And I know now that I don't want to go back and reread it. It's a book that I don't really want to revisit or the whole series because I have a very specific memory of it that's very positive, and I don't want to return to it being critical, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I sort of have this snapshot of holding the doll, my mother reading the book to me, and that being a very important thing. Not really having an understanding that I wanted to do history as a career, but just that I found it really compelling and that I liked the story of a young girl doing something important. I think that's part of what I found fascinating about it.
So what was she doing that you thought was important? Like, why Molly?
So I really remember that she wasn't perfect, if that strikes a chord. So I remember that she was a little bit awkward. She had glasses, which was aspirational for me at the time. In all seriousness, I loved books where young women had glasses and were very smart.
And you did not have glasses.
I did not have glasses, no. And I remember very specifically that part of her story arc was things happening at school. And I remember that if you kind of, you know, scraped your pennies together, she had a school kit and a desk and a knapsack, which I eventually was given as another gift. But I remember her doing victory gardening. I remember her doing what I would now understand as conservation work to help with the war effort. But I really just have this vision of her wearing the red, white, and blue outfit and participating in the patriotic dance. And I had no dance aspirations, but just feeling like her story had a positive message.
Yep. Yeah. And family was important. And
yeah, absolutely. And
it's kind of interesting when you say that you're not going to return to those stories. And in some ways, it's because we're both historians. And to, like, I guess, reread those books with our training might turn us into the, like, kind of academic people we hate who kind of ruin everything that's fun with, you know, their expertise and whatever. But there have been times when we've tried to remember the plot lines of those books and we've totally blown it.
That's correct. So we had sort of what I guess the psychologists would call a shared delusion,
yep.
which was that the story of Felicity took place not in Virginia, but in Boston.
Yep.
And we remembered a Sam Adams plot line that
sure.
I think did not exist.
I think we remembered her being like working or being friends with the Adamses.
Yes. And yes.
We were like, oh my God, she was overhearing John Adams
yes.
talk about defending the, you know, participants in the Boston Massacre. Like, we were in so deep.
Yes.
And then somebody was like, maybe you guys should Google that because that doesn't sound right.
And I think what mattered less was what actually happened as much as that we found her story interesting.
Yes.
And I just remember having some very small sliver of awareness that it was a big deal that these books were just for girls.
Yeah.
And I also read an awful lot of the Dear America books, which I know now have main figures with many different gender identifications, but at the time it was all young women.
Yeah.
As if I'm recalling that correctly, I only got the ones that were all women. And they were hardcover, which was different from American Girl, which is a little bit flimsier. And I have really strong memories of being taken to the bookstore and feeling like I'd gotten away with something by getting those books because I thought they were very expensive. And in retrospect, I think they were $12, which
yeah.
is not inexpensive for a book, but I kept them all on a special shelf that was different from everything else and really had this sense of, you know, this is sort of like my womanly corner of important things.
Yes.
In the way that a gentleman in the 19th century would have leather-bound books.
Like a cabinet of curiosity.
Yeah, like these were special to me in a very specific way. And they had ribbons so that they looked like an old-fashioned diary where you could keep a place. And I felt like these are important. The first set I read was about the Mayflower. And then I sort of went...
Ooh, that was a good one.
...in an order. Yeah. And I just thought they were very well written. And again, I think trying to read a children's book as an adult and revisit, I don't want to taint the way that I experienced it and reshape that memory, but
yeah.
I'm oddly comfortable with us rewriting the entirety of the Felicity series. So
sure, yeah. But I think that what's happening there too is that books become a way of relating to other people. And I know for us, the American Girl books have become a shorthand when we meet other women
True.
Of our generation. Like we were born in and around this year that Pleasant Company, the company that created American Girl, was created.
Correct.
So we literally grew up with the first generation of those books, and we kind of have that down pat. And even as we can't clearly remember the plot line of any of those books, I know that I'm a Molly.
Yeah, and I think the fact that we can both exist as Mollies.
Yeah.
And I think something that's been lost is the company that now makes them that we won't
name,
it's not important, now has built-in friends. So there are important characters who are friends. For example, Samantha has a very prominent friend, which is you know, not likely also. But I think what's sad about that is Molly sort of was my friend.
Mm-hmm.
She was a person where I felt a lot of understanding with, even though she was a fictional character. And I think with the company presenting a built-in friendship in the story with its own doll, like, to me, that doll and I had a friendship.
Yeah.
And that book, we were sort of this triangle. And I think something's missing when you force other dolls to be that doll's friend.
And also, like, now that company, that same company has shifted to make dolls that are, like, air quotes, you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're supposed to just map yourself onto a doll and sort of make a doll that mirrors you exactly, instead of presenting you with someone else who is presented to you as almost a full-fledged person with whom you could be friends and learn something. So I think something's lost there, too. Like, you can't really be friends with that doll. Or if you are, it's some weird narcissistic thing of like, I'm going to be friends with myself.
Yes.
Like, it just seems odd to me. But, I mean, I think for us, we can't really remember the plot lines of Felicity's books, for example. But when we meet people, women our age, we often do force them to answer the question, which American girl are you?
Yeah, and I think there are some that are non-starters.
Yeah, we hear certain names and it's like,
it's a tough challenge. It's a challenge.
Like, if somebody comes at you and says, I'm a Samantha, no questions asked, which people have said to us.
I think there are questions that need to be asked of that type of response. And I think there are other ones that actually raise bigger issues. Like, why does one want to be a Kirsten? If you're not Swedish, and if you are Swedish, that's a separate issue, but why the Kirsten?
Yeah.
Or, you know, on the other hand, I think for some people, the Felicity story is great. It's brave. The Molly story is great. It's brave. Now there are some that are so banal, I don't know why you would want to identify with them. Like, what is Julie really striving for? Julie is essentially trying to stay out of the badness of Haight Ashbury. Beyond that, I don't know what her story is.
Yeah. She's just hanging out. And someone else was in the War of 1812. Again, could ask a lot of questions about that. I don't know.
I think what's interesting, though, is, you know, that doll for me now is literally away and the books are literally away, but it's not a thing that I feel far from.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I think about very often, but, you know, we've talked a lot about how we have certain memories of books and they feel very close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, looking back in retrospect, the Molly book is one of easily hundreds that was read to me, and I can't remember almost anything out of most of them.
Yep.
You know, particularly before I could read myself. But I know that there's a trace of that because I was able to read from that experience of being read to.
I mean, for me, it's something I think back on, and it kind of grounds me in why I love history in the first place, because when I read those books, they were such an invitation to imagination, to imagine yourself living with Molly, going through her world, living through the war, seeing what her life was like. And then you would imagine yourself in this world. And at the end of the book, if you remember, and I know we've talked about this, there's that section where a historian would put mm-hmm. together an actual history of that time with photos and with some statistics or whatever it was. So then you would be kind of grounded in the sense of, wow, like, this actually happened. Mm-hmm. These were real challenges that people were dealing with. Even if the situation is fictional, here are some, like, entree points into thinking about the history of this time.
Yeah, and I think you and I would both agree, though, that ultimately if we were to revisit the books, I'm not actually terribly interested in what those sections have to offer.
No.
Now.
Yeah.
despite that being something that we're probably both somewhat equipped to do professionally.
Yeah.
I think what drew me to those books is, you know, you could argue that both of us think a lot about the line between fiction and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, what I read in those books has stayed with me and has stayed more compelling to me than a very large stack of more critical studies of the period. I think one of your best examples was, you know, is The Crucible not the best way to understand the 17th century versus a stack of books that attempt to offer you critique and understanding? I mean, in some ways, fiction has this power to transfix you in a way that reminds you of the realness and takes you away from holding a book and feeling like you're there.
Exactly, exactly. So even if small details aren't real, we know someone in common who once, we asked him what he thought of the John Adams book and miniseries. And he said something like, as soon as I saw the belt buckles were wrong, I had to turn it off.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's kind of foreclosing a larger truth or a sense that you could imagine yourself in that time, even if certain facts are wrong, that it might teach you something that you might not get otherwise. But anyway.
And just as a quick response to a very recent podcast interview, because I think it'll be cool to see how this podcast evolves and has layers. I don't want to say that anyone's reading of a book or a program is wrong, but objectively, I do have to disagree with the statement made previously that the Game of Thrones series, A Song of Ice and Fire, that the show is better than the book. I do have to objectively disagree with that assessment.
Wow.
But we can talk about that now or later.
All right, we'll circle back to that.
Okay.
And I'll remember to ask you about that. I know what episode you're talking about.
It's a recent wonderful episode.
I'm going to name names because I don't think you should be allowed to throw shade without naming names.
That's absolutely
acceptable. On this
podcast
or in life. Okay. So, did you read Harriet the Spy growing up?
I did read Harriet the Spy, and I very much enjoyed the film. Harriet the Spy is one of those stories that I think we should all have to read every few years if one has not read it already, because I think there's so much about it that's cautionary and compelling.
Okay.
I think Harriet the Spy probably spoke to me in the sense of she was incredibly inquisitive. My method of watching and learning about other people was not writing. It was using my Fisher-Price recorder. And so I actually very much responded to that piece of it. And
so you were just conducting investigations with your Fisher-Price recorder?
I don't know that I would call them investigations because I had no endpoint, but more queries. I will call them highly localized queries into things that were happening around me. And I think what was interesting about her life is she was a very smart person, young person in a world of adults. And I think part of that was the setting. It was Manhattan. But I think it's sort of obvious and maybe cliche, you know, and maybe the subjects of this podcast will echo this too much. But I think when you're a person who loves reading books about very smart young people is just very interesting to you. It does something for you. And you find models and you find sometimes examples of what not to do, as in Harriet the Spy.
So up your Fisher Price recorder then after reading Harriet the Spy?
So I think that those times were not concurrent, but I think perhaps I thought about that time a little bit differently.
So who are you recording then? Who's getting investigated? Or who's the subject of your query?
I'm going to take the fifth on that. But what I will say is I think one thing that people who write really good fiction and write really good historical nonfiction is we all have that Harriet the Spy impulse. You know, we're looking for those details. We're chasing down leads. And a lot of times, let's be frank, we're solving non-mysteries. Like, we're solving things that no one has asked about, or we're trying to put together puzzles that no one even knew existed.
Sure.
So I think in some ways, her investigations of things that don't matter. I mean, the difference between a historian and a creep is the people we're tracking down are dead. Right? I mean,
that's true.
I mean, not a totally set and dry binary, but
I think that's fair because we're in the only socially acceptable occupation in which you can read someone else's diary.
That's correct. That's correct.
I think that's a fair thing.
And private investigation.
Yeah, which is a career field that we both kind of aspire to.
Yes.
I mean, you've looked into it. There's some coursework. We're thinking about it.
Yes.
But I think you have the background. I need to reread Harriet the Spy before I can take up my fake badge, but I'm ready.
Me too.
So where do you go next in your life as a reader? You have American Girl, you have Harriet the Spy, now you're reading to yourself, presumably. What are the books that you're choosing for yourself?
So sort of in that vein, I loved Nancy Drew, which I know is also an interest that we share. So I was first given a very old Nancy Drew, and full disclosure, I have various iterations of the Nancy Drew series. So I have everything from the 80s parts of the series that were written much later and after the original author and authors had passed away. But I also have 1930s versions. I have 1950s versions. So I actually have a I would say, a decent library ranging from the different eras. And I'm sure if I looked back now, I'd catch even more nuance of how Nancy changes. But I remember very, very clearly that one of her first mysteries was at a circus.
Hmm.
And she solves this circus mystery. And when you really think about it, some of what she's getting into is incredibly dangerous. And some of it is totally banal, right? There's the Sapphire mystery, which I don't remember the stakes actually being very high. But really loved holding an old book in my hands. And I had these beautiful old Nancys. And I also, frankly, loved the hardback plastic, the very plasticky Nancys that were meant to look older. And I would say from there, talking about middle school, roughly that age, I sort of deviated from peers in not reading Harry Potter.
Ooh, controversial point.
Yeah, so I feel like that has to be said, and I will, full disclosure, note that I have read all of the other J.K. Rowling books that are not Harry Potter, which I know is a controversial place to stand.
You are literally the only person I know who has once said, after reading, I think, The Casual Vacancy.
Yes.
And some others, you know, based on these books, I might just check out Harry Potter.
Yes, I've signed
one to watch, J.K. Rowling.
Right. I mean, I concluded, wow, she's quite a sharp writer, and I was very impressed. Trying to think back to that period, I really enjoyed, as a young person in elementary school, checking out library books. And I will note that a point of pride is second grade, we had a town-wide competition, and who could read the most books over the summer? And I came in second, which I'm actually still very proud of. And I will note that the person who came in first, her family did not own a television, which I think one should have to have a handicap in the process of
So if somebody
ranking.
Enters in, say you were competing against an Amish person.
Right. I mean, I think they should have a handicap that, of course, there's some more time for those kinds of diversions.
Not that you would stay away from the TV.
Right. I mean, I think I had a very balanced sense of self, so I could incorporate all. So
wow.
I was recently reflecting on that, actually, because I was at a meeting with a librarian for work, and we were talking about how contests really can drive reading in important ways. And I remembered that contest, and it was actually the first time I had ever thought about the fact that there was no prize for winning and how seriously I took this competition. And my second place award, which I'm sure I have somewhere, has Miss Frizzle on it, and it says congratulations.
Wow.
But I think at most, you know, a winner got a sticker. But I just remember that being important to me, that I wanted to win and that I wanted to do that thing.
Well, you're a very rules-based person. And you
right.
also love being rewarded for following rules.
Correct.
I mean, I'm not going to cite another award that you came second in or were not given. It involves your uniform.
That's correct. I was, I would say, wrongfully not awarded a perfect uniform award, which we can talk about in depth if someone's curious. But it does remind me, I've set at times arbitrary goals for myself. For example, when Barnes & Noble used to have books on the bag, I set a goal for myself of reading every book that was on the Barnes & Noble bag. And some of them were way above my comprehension level, and it was just led to frustration.
Is this middle school?
Yeah.
Okay.
So The Sound and the Fury did not go well, just to cite one example. I did get to read some classics that I'm glad I read. The breaking point was they kept changing the bag. So I then switched to, well, whatever they have posters of in the Barnes & Noble.
Got it.
So they have these large versions of book covers. That also struck out when my Barnes & Noble relocated, and then I realized this is sort of foolish. This isn't a way to structure a reading list, but that was one way that I got myself into reading for a while.
But at least you had a system, which doesn't surprise me at all about you.
Yeah, so I think at various points, you know, that little competitive drive was useful. I remember in middle and high school, I read a lot, again, on the bus. I had a really long bus ride.
How long?
Over an hour each way.
Wow.
And I read a lot in that time. And one of the books I really enjoyed was Fanny Flagg's Fried Green Tomatoes. And I know there's a fuller title, but really enjoyed some of those types of books. And
why do you think that book spoke to you?
I love the film, first of all. I'd seen the film first. Absolutely love the film. I really find the story interesting. It's not, I wouldn't say there's a single chapter out of that book that relates really to anything in my life. You know, there's tremendous loss of, you know, sibling relatives. There's tremendous physical loss. You know, there's an amputation at one point. I think the friendship between Ruth and Iggy is what really drew me to the story. And I think the film actually does a phenomenal job of painting that in really interesting strokes. But I grew to like those kinds of books, Where the Heart Is, you know, those types of stories. And I would guess, and someone could, you know, call me on my chronology, that was concurrent with Oprah's book club. And so I think a lot of what I was reading were trickle-down books from other people of what was on her club. So I can picture the O even today on some of these books.
Did you ever watch the episodes where O talks about those books?
So I wasn't home early enough most of the time, but I do remember.
Sad.
Correct.
Days before DVR.
I do remember really distinctly people talking about her, kind of bringing reading back. And I'm sure that was true for a lot of people. I think being a reader was something always associated with me, so I don't think, you know, I was also probably 12, you know, there was nothing to really bring back. But I think what probably drew me to those books was fully formed people. I really did not have a period where I read what I would call teen books, except for Babysitter's Club. And I will go out on a limb. I read the Little Sisters series, and I thought they were quite good.
Agree to disagree.
So I found Karen's stories to be more, with more depth than I think most people have given them credit for.
What?
If I recall, Karen brought a really interesting perspective to the series because she was kind of an outsider looking in. And I grew to find Christy absolutely insufferable.
Allison!
Which I know is a controversial opinion. So I think I liked what Christy brought to the table. I was not impressed with Claudia.
Wow.
You know, I grew to like Brave. The younger people in the series.
What about Marianne?
I think looking back, there are problems with the Marianne character
arc. Such as?
I think in a lot of ways, her relationships with other people were really toxic in ways that she couldn't articulate.
But you can?
Correct. I mean, I think when you really look back, she was very much bossed by Christy. She really lacked her own voice. I think she was sort of the maternal stooge in the stories. She was the only one, I think, that really had the gift for caregiving, but was also a pushover. I think she lacked the leadership instinct the others had.
Wow.
I know those are some harsh words, but I think the evidence would bear them out.
What? Allison, I feel like I need, like, some counseling. Like, I don't, like, I may have to reevaluate our whole relationship. I mean,
I will say, I thought Dawn had some of the best stories, and I very, very much enjoyed the short series that were written of, they were supposed to be read like scrapbooks.
Yep.
And I thought Dawn had the best scrapbook. Hers was a visit to San Francisco.
Yep.
Remember a lot of details from that.
That was a good one.
I think in some ways we were all supposed to admire Christy, and one was in a difficult spot if that wasn't natural. Right?
Uh-huh. So that's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough if you're not a fan of Christy.
And I know I have, you know, another controversial opinion, so I'll just put this out there. Beth is my favorite character in Little Women. And I will note that that's also my middle name. And I know that in previous episodes of this podcast, that's been talked about in great length. But I think she presents a lot of purity that is both emblematic of the time in which the book was written and rare, generally, in literature. I think people have a hard time taking her seriously because she's so pure and sympathetic.
But I think there are a lot of characters like Beth in 19th century novels, and the trope is that the only way they can stay that pure is to die.
I think it's fair and in some ways convenient to put her in that box, but I guess for me, Beth is more than that category. Is that a fair assessment?
That's fair.
I think it's very easy to look at her as the angelic trope who eventually dies before she can really have heartbreak or move out or move on. But I think she has some of the most deep lines in the book. And Joe was not attractive to me. Joe was not a character that I emulated in the movie or in the book.
Why?
I think it was something about the way her ambition expressed itself.
Okay.
I think ultimately Marnie is probably the hero of the story.
Yeah.
For all that she does to really push both family and independence. I think that there are ways in which Jo is very much a trope that people don't like to admit. I think she was new for her period, and ever since has that archetype has been used as a trope in ways that are not compelling to me.
Okay. Fair enough. I think that's a brave view, and I respect that. I will say this is all making me flash back to one time when you and I, if you remember this, when we were in grad school, we organized a film festival called Hail to the Bale, which was a double feature of films featuring one Christian Bale, including Little Women with Winona Ryder and Kirsten Dunst and whoever else was in that movie. And you just bravely announced, first of all, we did ask everyone there to tell us which March sister they identified with, men included.
That's correct.
And it was overwhelmingly Jo, except for one person who said Aunt March, also brave.
Very brave, and I think a great answer
lot of ways. I loved it. And also you. And you kind of had to defend yourself to an entire room of...
I did.
People who have made terrible life choices.
I think many of us are Megs.
Yep.
Far more than we care to admit. I think there's a lot of Amys in the world, particularly at present. And nobody really wants to admit that they are a Beth, Amy, a Meg, or even a Marnie, or the dad. I mean, who really knows what he's up to?
Giant question mark.
I think in a lot of ways it was genius for Louisa May Alcott to set it during the Civil War, because her own father might as well have been away at war. He was so non-functional, non-useful to the family, in the household, or wherever he was. Looking back, honestly, I think when I first read it, I was very young, didn't even really understand the Civil War context, and I think it took multiple viewings of the film to even get that, because to me it was about the family in that house. And maybe I disliked Jo's plot lines because it took me away from that house. You know, her ventures in New York, all these different things. You know, I want to be back in Orchard House and hearing what's going on there.
Which is odd kind of to hear in some ways, because your professional life is so associated with the idea of the home and the family. And yet, you know, if you were asked to, say, make a Christmas breakfast to bring to the German family, very sick... I don't know. I mean, I'm not throwing shade at you. I guess if we could, like, make Eggos, we'd be fine. But I would say, like, being domestic is not necessarily... The domestic is a great interest of yours. Being domestic is not.
I think that's absolutely accurate. That's absolutely accurate. And I think part of why I have that interest is because I live in a time where I absolutely don't have to be invested in it at all. And I think it's always intriguing to do a kind of thought experiment. Like, if I truly were responsible for raising my own food, how good could I become at that task? And I think now it's sort of an inverse relationship where it's how little do I have to do to feed myself?
The answer is very little.
And then that's kind of the challenge, and in some ways why we have the health problems that we have today. But I do think there's some truth to that book being so home-centered, and again, part of my interest being home economics. I think there's a pretty solid line you can draw from the 1850s to today, which is increasingly we don't need to live in one house in familial units to get things done, but we still prefer that arrangement, and why? There are intangible things, you know, not laundry, not cooking, that people are seeking. Otherwise, we'd all be living in communitarian projects, right?
Yeah, totally. So, in your timeline now, we're in high school with you. What kind of person is high school Allison, and what kind of books is she reading? And is there a relationship between the two?
So, high school Allison, admittedly, totally captivated by the Da Vinci Code.
Ooh.
Full disclosure. Totally captivated by that book. Very much enjoyed reading it. Strong memories of not being able to put it down when the bus stopped at school, and really a total spin out from that into an Illuminati interest that I would say persists to a small degree. really just becoming very interested in this whole world of mysticism, of the Masons. And I think probably the Masons in particular, because I was at an all-girls school. So it's kind of fascinating to think of myself as being in this one homosocial enclave and knowing there's all these others, right, that have existed for hundreds of years. I would say the Da Vinci Code did a public service in terms of awakening people to questioning elements of religion and mysticism. Obviously, I didn't take it, you know, full scale. I didn't take the whole story as truth. But I think for me, it raised a lot of questions at a time where that was useful to me.
What were you questioning at that time?
So I think being in Catholic school, you're obviously presented with theology as well as ritual, but I also was presented with really, really good female role models. And I went to a school that was a Sisters of Mercy institution, and I still think incredibly highly of the people who taught me there, particularly the women, not exclusively, but especially the women and the nuns, and having this relationship where what I had read and known about nuns still doesn't jive up with what I experienced in terms of Catholicism at a Sisters of Mercy school, which I think is sort of unique within the world of religion in some ways.
Yeah.
Because it's in this very large and to some degree somewhat oppressive larger institution, and yet here's these women who do amazing things, are highly educated, and sort of out of time in a lot of ways. I think reading and learning since then, you know, being an early 21st century Sister of Mercy really means that you are completely out of step with what the world expects of you as a Catholic and as a woman. And I think being able to read books that were asking questions and having these very smart teachers at the same time was incredibly useful to me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It seems like what a great place to kind of like start thinking about what kind of person you want to be and what kind of interests you want to make your own. So what happens next?
So I would say going to college opened up a totally new way of reading to me. And I'm sure I'll remember other books that were important to me as a younger person. But going into college, I feel like I learned how to read again. In a lot of ways, I felt like prior to college, I was a very competent reader, was a decently fast reader. And then I go to college and, you know, it's the Matrix. All these layers get stripped back. Everything is new again. And not a popular opinion, I would say, in 21st century, but I read a lot of the classics, and I essentially had a kind of training that I think might be gone at some point, and I won't bemoan that, but simply reading a lot of classics, rereading the Bible from a rigorous perspective, I think is totally invaluable to people. And I was just reading in an alumni bulletin about, you know, why read the classics in 2017. And I loved one of the responses, which was, in some ways, everything old is new again. And there's no better way to learn that than the classics and to understand people through the classics. That said, you know, while I was struggling through some of them, I thought it was positively awful. I hate reading the Odyssey. I'll never look at it again. But that process taught me something.
What was a classic that really stayed with you that you might pick up again?
I would say once I got through it, you know, sort of obvious, but I loved reading Herodotus. And the more I understood it, I loved reading Thucydides. I would say philosophy, I probably won't pick up too much more of. I think that will probably sit on the side. But I look back at who I thought I was going to be at 17, 18, and who I became, you know, in the past 12 years. I was pre-med in college and was very set on that path and had decided to be part of a classics interdisciplinary program, sort of as what I thought would be the ultimate coup for my med school application. I'd been told that if one looked well-rounded and well-studied, it was a lot better to get into med school than having a bio major. So here I'm thinking I'm pulling off this incredible thing, and it just turned my whole world upside down in other ways and became a history major. So
what happened?
I think I realized the world was in a lot of ways a lot more complicated than I ever imagined. And the way I always think of it, it's like I realized that the wall was one color and that one could look from different angles. And yes, maybe today the wall looks a little bit orange, maybe today it's a little bit red. And then someone, you know, first taking a peeler and showing me that there's actually 18 layers of wallpaper, and then eventually giving me a tool where I could knock the wall down. I mean, to me, that's what going to college did in some ways. And feeling like I had this tremendous gift. I mean, to me, college was my reward for going to high school. I found high school hard and challenging in the sense of not so much academically, but it was hard. You know, it was rigorous. I went to a high school that expected a lot. It was very competitive. And when I felt prepared and like I had good time management skills in college, I thought, this is my reward for doing well at this other thing. And I think it's this tremendous privilege to get to read for hours on end and have that be a thing you do for 4 years. And I think people try too hard to make liberal arts utilitarian. And I think there's still something to be said for knowing that you and millions of other people before you took a few years out of your life to read, knowing and appreciating that that's a tremendous gift that people don't get, was important to me.
Very good. So what else are you reading then? If you were managing your time, you presumably have some free time to watch some trash TV. And
that's right.
And around those great programming, that great programming, maybe you read for fun.
So college, roughly around that time, is when I picked up my first Jodi Picoult book. And I've since read every Jodi Picoult book, and I am proud to say I can almost always read them in one day. So that's kind of a thing that I've acquired along the way. Again, sort of, if I like an author, I'm going to commit to it. I'm going to read all of it the best that I can. Really, really like her books because I like the idea of a built-in twist that I, as the reader, as I get better at reading her books, can anticipate.
Are you disappointed if you figure it out, or do you want to figure it out?
I absolutely want to figure it out. I'm devastated if I don't.
Really?
I would say there's only a couple of her books where I did not figure it out, and I, maybe it's my hubris, I blame it on the construction of the book, where I think the twist was not as planned or as embedded as it should have been.
What was that
to
book?
To be reliable. I'm trying to remember now. I just remember being disappointed with my experience.
Ooh.
I read her most recent book, which I thought was absolutely wonderful, which is about great things, and it's about race in America. And the twist was surprising but not shocking to me.
Okay.
I had anticipated which character would be the source of the shock and roughly what would happen, if that makes sense. The first book I read of hers was Plain Truth, which is about an Amish family, which is a wonderful book. Also a Lifetime feature film.
Oh, yeah. Great film.
And what I like about her writing is I like books that switch perspectives, which is also what George R. R. Martin does very, very well. You somehow find it totally convincing that, you know, in her case, this 40-year-old from New Hampshire, or in his case, this older fantasy writer man, can completely get into the head of a 9-year-old girl. And just do it so well and so brilliantly. I mean, that to me is really talent.
And speaking of shifting perspectives, do you find it compelling when then those films, Jodi Picoult films, are made into films?
Yes. And we had mentioned earlier, I have been really on an exponential curve disappointed with Game of Thrones as a television program.
Now, let me just set the stage. You read that. I knew you.
Yes.
We met when I first started grad school. You were a year ahead of me. And I think it was that summer.
It was the summer of 2011 that I read that series. And I know, I can explain why I know that.
Okay, go for it.
So I read the first 4 books in the series in 4 weeks. Maybe a few days over. And I happened to start that process a month before the release date of book 5. And I finished in time to read book 5 2 days after it came out. And I have this great memory of sitting in a public place reading it and another fan coming up to me and saying, you know, we've just waited so long for this. And I totally did not have the heart to tell him that I waited like 30 hours for my now husband to finish it. I just didn't have the heart to tell him that I had waited less than 2 days. But I read those books in pretty rapid succession, I think part because they're very good. I like the story. It's really, other than a few Stephen King books, the only fantasy that I'm really willing to delve into, I think.
What about Harry Potter?
I would say Harry Potter might get a chance someday. It's just so low on my priorities, if that's fair.
That might be the most controversial thing you've said on this episode.
I think now that I know what a great writer J.K. Rowling is for myself, hear me out, her portraits of modern day people are so gripping to me.
Yeah.
I don't know why I want to add unicorns. Fair?
No, you don't understand what you're talking about.
I think I also am afraid of what, and then I will say this, I think had I read them in middle school, Hermione might have been an uncomfortable mirror for me that maybe I don't need in my life. Is that fair?
Again, I'm going to, like, withhold all comment until you actually read these books.
Okay. I mean, I was sort of swayed by the notion that she's the hero of the series.
Yes, episode one of this podcast, Jordan makes that argument.
Okay.
Or I think it's a different episode, but Jordan says that. Yeah. So it's all out there for you. You can take it all in.
I would say I've also gone through, since and during college, periods where I read a lot of nonfiction by journalists. And I think part of that was I was looking for facts and interesting stories put together. Mm-hmm. And couldn't understand why that was so hard to find.
Well, and don't you think, too, that being a historian, the quality of academic history writing is not necessarily, or it's a different style. Let's say it's just a different way of thinking.
I think there's something unfortunately clinical. Yes. About a lot of books that I've read looking back. And I would cite really important exceptions. Like, I would say a book that changed my life was The Diary of Martha Ballard, full stop, by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich.
Yes.
It's a book that I know a ton of people working in museums and public history love because it's so good. But what I love about that book is this historian takes a source that people say isn't important, isn't revelatory, and rings out something like 20 chapters.
Maybe can you say a little bit about what that book is for people who don't know?
Of course. So Martha Ballard is a late 18th, early 19th century midwife living up in Maine when that is still kind of transitioning from being part of the Massachusetts Bay frontier to being a state. And this woman just kept meticulous records about her life, deliveries she made, the ways that her husband experienced debt. You know, he goes to debtor's prison. And
crime.
She's...
Crime. Remember?
Crime.
God, that murder.
What I love about that book is it's this total Rorschach where everyone remembers different things. No offense.
What are you saying? That me remembering a murder says something about me?
No, but I think we all, in those 20-something odd chapters, learn different things about the past and about ourselves. And to me, that book changed the game for what historians could do with a single source, mm-hmm. which I love.
So what did you learn about yourself? You said everyone who reads that book learns something about themselves.
I think I learned that I could do the study I wanted to do and that it was legitimate in graduate school because I wanted to focus largely in a very in-depth way on one person. And I picture The Diary of Martha Ballard, like Martha is the center of a huge wheel and we have all these spokes going everywhere and cobwebs in between the spokes. And that and a few other books made me say, you know what, I can do the study I want to do and write this thing that I want to write and have people learn a lot from it. And I will say I'm not too into biographies. I don't read a ton of them. I read them of people I find super interesting. Like, I've done the whole series on Teddy Roosevelt. You know, there's some people that I think totally warrant that much of my time.
Yeah.
But I think that there's something really incredible about a historian taking an old, dusty diary that literally multiple people said, you just can't learn that much from it. And I think turning on its head a lot of what we thought we knew about people's lives 200 years ago.
Yeah, and what's amazing about that book, I mean, again, this might be something that tells you something about me, I don't know, but there's a part in the book where someone offhand references that the American Revolution is taking place.
Yes.
It's basically just this, like, throwaway comment. Like, oh, is that still going on? Like, oh, okay.
And I recall that there's a parade, and again, this may be us sharing a not real memory.
A delusion.
But that she's not, that Martha Ballard is actually not particularly interested in it.
Yeah.
And I think, and I actually remember this quite clearly from high school. I remember studying the French Revolution. And I remember people in my class being very fired up. And I remember saying a very unpopular thing, which was that had all of us been alive as women, we probably would have had nothing to do with it. And since you know a bit about my historical work, that's actually pretty congruent with how I see most things.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is to find people alive for great events and to find them, I don't want to say unfazed by them, but just sort of leading these extraordinary lives almost in spite of it.
Yeah.
Like, I love Abigail Adams as much as the next person, but realistically, most 18th century women were not hunkering down, were not writing to a man at the Continental Congress. They were just hungry.
Yeah.
They were tired and they were cold and they were afraid to go outside to the bathroom. And I think that's why I love that book so much.
Yeah. I think for a lot of women historians that I know, that book is really foundational just because of all those reasons that you've articulated. And it's not something that if you've ever, like, gone to college and you've had to read an academic book and you really struggled through the language or the, you know, whatever is going on. What's so powerful about that book is that anyone can pick it up. It's actually making really sophisticated arguments, but the language is very plain spoken. It's very simply written and it's told as a story, and it's just really powerful. So to me, that's really inspiring.
I would say another book that I found really inspirational and complicated is The Sea Captain's Wife.
Oh, yeah.
By Martha Hodes. And that's a story about what we might call an interracial relationship before, during, and after the Civil War. And I think what a lot of us are increasingly drawn to is books that are written in a very raw way. You know, I tried, you know, with the narrator kind of saying or explicitly noting, I tried to go down this research path and it failed. And here's, you know, how that made me feel. And here's how I got back up again. And I think to a large degree, you know, every book is written about the author and the subject. I was having a conversation last night with my husband about Lord of the Rings. And apparently Tolkien was adamant that that series is not allegorical. And I just can't fathom a world in which that story is not an allegory or a parable.
Have you read it?
I've read The Hobbit.
Okay.
And I think that gives me enough ground to stand
on. I think
it
does.
But,
sure.
But,
so you think it's not, you think it is an allegory?
I think most things in time prove to be allegorical.
Do you think of your own work that way? So do you think somebody who picks up your dissertation, as I've encouraged every listener of this episode to do, and whatever future book comes of it, do you think if somebody sat down, first tell us what your dissertation is about, and then imagine somebody reading your book, what story about you do you think they're going to get from it?
I think a lot of the story that I tell in that study has to do with academia. And the way that...
Well, first tell us what
sure,
it is.
Sure.
And then tell us how you read it.
Happy to do that. So my study is focused on a sort of singular, but in some ways representative home economist named Flemmi Cottrell. She is usually noted as the first black woman to achieve a PhD in home economics. And sometimes that distinction is noted as sort of a curiosity or like a fun fact, as it's appeared a few times on Reddit. And I found her whole career arc, which ends up including an awful lot of work for the State Department, international work, just very fascinating because it's a story of upending expectations. And it's also a story of how I think a lot of people, particularly academics, like to imagine that, for example, the Ivy League is the Ivy League is the Ivy League. Right? That's where great smart people go. That's where there's privilege. And I sort of stumbled across this story that I found a lot more interesting, which is institutions are made up of buildings and bodies and personalities, and they change. And we have this almost mythical attachment to an idea of what a college or a university is. And just getting knee deep in archives, particularly in the South, such as at Tuskegee and Hampton, I found people making really hard choices, and I found people changing institutions from within and basically making disciplines what they want. And I think we're sort of coming into our professional selves at a time where people are essentially trying to uphold a status quo of what our field is while simultaneously inventing what I would say is something to kind of soothe the potential for tumult, which is called alt-ac, alternative academic work. And I find myself really drawn more to what academics were doing 100 years ago than now. Hmm. And so I would say that's a large part of why I was drawn to tell the story, because I think we learn a lot from them, and I think people have made a cottage industry out of criticizing reformers from 100 years ago without actually understanding the way that they benefit from the institutions they built.
Mm, very interesting. So is that what you hope people take away from it?
I think if anything, you know, if someone reads something that I've written, I think if anything strikes them as changing the way they see the past, that's a win. And I think some historians want to prove a point. And of course, I want to do that too, right? You know, I have arguments that I make and hopefully scaffold and explain. But I think the best moments I've ever had in reading were moments that totally made me pause and rethink the way that people were and are. Like the Great Cat Massacre is a great example of that. I just think about that book, and it was a book I read while studying abroad, and I didn't have to read it. We had to pick a book almost at random and read and report on it. And I just remember looking at the cover and being so horrified and wanting to know. And I think the question of what do people find funny is timeless, because the answers are always so different. Mm. Like in the Great Cat Massacre, people massacre cats and then laugh hysterically. And you find out it's basically this safety valve for a certain period in France where people can commit these awful acts and then move on because it's better than them killing their masters. Mm. So I think books like that that totally make you pause and think about the world differently, that's a total win.
Do you think about the books that will, or the books, I use the term loosely, that might be used to write our history? Like, for example, you and I are both readers of, we've talked about some high-level reading.
Yes.
We also take part in what some would call low, but I would reject that label.
Correct.
We read people, we read Us Weekly.
I would say diligently. I read Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah. What are those reading those things? What do they do for your life?
So I've actually been thinking about why I read those a little bit, not in preparation for this, but I've also been trying to be a little bit more reflective about why I read so much true crime and why I listen to so much true crime. And it's very easy to draw a straight line from me listening to true crime 2 hours a day and then, you know, being totally spooked when a closet shuts, you know, from the wind. Regardless, I think what I like about all of those stories is I just genuinely like reading about people. And People magazine is known for exposés and oftentimes poorly reported stories about celebrities. But there's also a lot of stories about real people. Mm-hmm. And I will say the editions that always make me feel most cheated are the ones with weight loss stories, because there's no story there. There's no arc. It's the same story. And I look forward to reading about, you know, people doing a good thing in their community, or the way someone had an epic comeback, you know, in the roller skating field or whatever it is. And I find People and Us do that for me, and they give me the backstory on things I'm interested in. And
21 things you don't know about me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what's in your purse? I want to know.
Me too.
And I like people, and we can talk about this at length. You know, I like people who are very self-conscious storytellers. I would say Kim Kardashian is excellent at that. I would say Lena Dunham strives to be excellent at that. And I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
Having read her book.
Wow. So, okay, have you read many? What did you make of her book and the celebrity memoir genre as a whole?
I think she's a good writer. I think she can paint a scene. I think she raises a lot of questions for me. I'm referring to Not That Kind of Girl about, and we talked about, you know, being a historian, you're exposing things in people's lives. in a lot of ways. And I think the word reckless comes to mind. And I think that there's such power in still having something go to print. One has to be really careful to not be reckless with how you tell someone else's story. And I think she's demonstrated over and over that she has an investment in telling her perspective of a story, regardless of how that might impact the subject.
Do you think that telling someone else's story in print has this different level of ethics than, say, telling on someone else via, I don't know, Snapchat?
Like, yes.
If we think about Kim Kardashian and the whole Taylor Swift Snap video reveal that she had, in fact, agreed to Kanye West using her name and likeness in a music video without, and then claimed later she'd never given her permission. Do you think that there's a difference between making someone vulnerable in your own book versus doing so on social media?
I think the difference is that they're peers, and the people Dunham is talking about are not her peers anymore. And don't have the same level of voice to be able to respond.
So if you're reading something in someone else's voice, you were talking about biography a minute ago, to think about if you read a Teddy Roosevelt bio and you don't like it, you might come away from thinking, I don't like the way this historian has told Teddy's story.
Oh, sure.
I would have done something differently. Like, we've talked about bios that we particularly like. But if you read, a celebrity memoir or memoir period, sometimes you take the risk of leaving that memoir thinking, wow, I really admired this person beforehand, and now they've shown me who they are, and I can't really handle it.
Yeah, and I think that's where level of access is so intriguing. As you know, we're both quite fond of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh, yes.
And people have made some really kind of interesting volleys about work on her, related to her, which is that some of the people who've had the most access, people actually don't find their work as credible because then they see the Queen as gatekeeping. So people have actually gotten pretty far into her circle, as much as that's possible. Some people then turn around and say, well, you can't really trust that account because she's so sort of embedded with the Queen. Kitty Kelly, on the other hand, who we're both interested in,
yep. You
know, her biography of Oprah is fascinating. I don't know if it's all true.
It's a great story, whether or not it's true.
I would say I read every biography as, what a great story.
Yeah.
An exception, I think Candace Millard is one of the best up-and-coming biographers of our time. She wrote a wonderful book on President Garfield, a wonderful book on Roosevelt and the River of Doubt, and she paints such a rich picture without trying to convince you that she's giving you the account of Roosevelt or Garfield, which I really appreciated.
Very good. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you have a zine-making arrangement to go to. What's a book that you've read recently that you really feel strongly about, you want to recommend?
I can tell you what I'm reading right now is a few things. I am in the Kim Kardashian book club.
Yep.
So I have that book, which I'm going through a little bit slowly. The book is, I think, Drawn Into the Light. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm also currently reading Blood in the Water by Heather Richardson. You know, just light stuff.
Yeah. Just a little nighttime, bedtime reading.
I really was moved by Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad. And I've been doing a lot of thinking around that book lately. And I think part of why people have a hard time with it is it's not chronologically bound. He talks about very clear historical events that did not happen concurrently with slavery. But I think what I liked about it so much is he pushed me, and I think I'm pretty liberal with, you know, using fiction to teach history. He pushed me to move that line, I would say, a little bit further. I also recently finished The Alchemist, and I would say it was not as transformative as I'd hoped, but maybe one should not go in hoping for a transformation with a book. I would say I am drawn to books for lots of reasons. I do subscribe to your method a little bit of letting books call to me. One of the more compelling things that will get me to read a book is seeing it on the 7-day shelf at my library. it creates this sort of weird capitalist demand where I feel like, well, it must be great and I have to read it. And I will do my darndest to get through it, no matter what, even if it's not great. So I think I'm drawn to books for all sorts of reasons. But in terms of picking one book as of late, you know, I think we're always finding books and books find us that we need to read for different reasons. So I'm always kind of on the lookout for the next thing that I should be reading, whatever that is.
Good answer. All right. Well, thank you, Allison. I appreciate you being on the show.
I'm happy to do it.
I'd like to thank our guest, Allison, for sharing her story with us. I'd also like to thank our technical director, Taylor, for all of her help. You can follow us on Instagram at ChaptersPod. There you'll find Shelby's submitted by our guests, including some by Allison. You can find us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123 and Taylor at MJTThePhD. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. You can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode on our website. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.